You, if something moves you, you experience something deep inside of you. That something deep inspires you to action, or sometimes maybe even a verbal response or an emotional response like weeping or anger. Forgot my handkerchief. Did the headlines move you this week? Consider the death of Dante Wright due to a gunshot from a police officer in Minneapolis, of all places. Does it move you that parents lost their son? Does it move you that a veteran police officer who very likely made a tragic mistake is going to have her life drastically changed? She's a mother too, I believe. Our passage today addresses what should move us. Does it move you that a liberal, extremist, radical politician, they continue to use these situations as a platform and an excuse to push a radical agenda on our nation? A radical agenda based upon an anti-Christian worldview, an anti-biblical worldview. One of these politicians tweeted last week, "Dante Wright's killing was not a random, disconnected accident. It was the repeated outcome of an indefensible system that grants impunity for state violence, rewards it with endlessly growing budgets at the cost of community investment, and targets those who question that order." End of quote. Now, it doesn't take a lot of digging to refute pretty much everything that's in that tweet. It's kind of interesting that that person comes from what I would consider a communistic or socialistic perspective that condones state violence. Look at the millions that have been killed over in just the last century because of communism and that kind of philosophy. Was Dante Wright targeted for questioning the order of an indefensible system? No way. Dante Wright was simply pulled over for having an expired license plate sticker. I guess they use stickers up in Minnesota. But in a sense, Dante was targeted. Why? Because Dante put the bullseye on himself, in a sense. If you read the news reports about who, what he did and what he done, he apparently hadn't come to trial yet, but he was in a lineup identified as a person who had pulled out a gun and was trying to rob a woman at gunpoint. And there was a warrant out for his arrest. Why? He was out on bail. Because he failed to appear in court on charges that he fled from officers and possessed a gun without a permit during an encounter with police last June, all right? So even before this incident, he had fled from police and was known to possess a gun. So let's pause for a moment and consider the Christian worldview. Every man and woman in this world and has a bullseye on them. And why do we have a bullseye on us? Because we have disobeyed God. We have broken His law. Everyone is guilty. We are all under a sentence of death. Every person born into this world is born under a sentence of death. When we will all have a day in God's court. You won't be able to blame anybody. You won't be able to blame your parents, your family, your race, your society, politicians, police, the government, drugs, or alcohol. You will only have yourself to blame. That's why it's so evil and dangerous in our society that this concept of victimhood is becoming so prevalent. Our society is elevating victimhood. And what are we doing? We are diminishing personal responsibility in our nation. Personal responsibility for our actions. But the way our nation views us isn't the way that God views us. When you stand before God, you won't have anybody else to blame but yourself. So what was your first response when you heard of the shooting of Dante? Did you mentally, verbally sigh or groan? That was my first reaction. I'm saddened by his death. I feel sorry for his family. You know, I have four daughters. I don't have sons, but put yourself in their position. I feel sorry for the police officer and her family as well. Each family's lives are going to be changed forever. In our passage today, Jesus sighs or groans, as some translations have it. There are times in this passage where we should be expected to sigh. And there's a fine line between the difference between a sigh and a groan. And often a sigh is expressed as a bit of a groan. And I don't know if it's because I've gotten older, but I find myself sighing more. So I remember something perhaps I've done as a knuckleheaded teenager. I don't know, you know, it's just, why do these come back to me as I grow older? I don't know. Now, in order to prepare you for the appropriate time in this passage to sigh, we're going to have some sighing practice, all right? Because we're going to sigh together as a congregation. We're going to sigh with a bit of groaning, and it should sound maybe something like this. Oh, you know, have you ever done that? Something happens, you're like, oh. Maybe it's something dumb you did. Maybe it's something, you know, just like, oh. So, all right, everybody, let's pray. Ready? 1, 2, 3. All right, that was pretty good, all right? That was good. So this passage has a challenge for us. So if you're taking notes and you're doing the blanks, the challenge is, what moves Jesus must move us. What moves Jesus must move us. And this morning we're going to highlight two groups of people that should move us. We must be moved by compassion. So that's the next answers there. Moved by compassion for these two groups of people. Right? I'm not going to give you the groups of people yet, so you have to be patient. So I invite you to turn to Mark chapter 7, verse 31. You can find that on page 1002 in the Bible in the Seat, if you're using that. Page 1002, Mark chapter 7, verse 31. It's nice to see a lot of you have turned there already. So, reading verses 31 and 32. Then Jesus returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hand on him. So last week, Jesus was in a Gentile area, and Jesus is again in a mostly Gentile area. And what happened the last time that Jesus was in the region of the Decapolis? Well, back in chapter 5, Jesus cast out many demons from one man. And what did the demons do? They entered a herd of pigs on the hillside and then rushed down the bank into the Sea of Galilee and drowned. And as a result, what did the people of the region do? They begged Jesus. They begged him to leave. Here the people from the same region are begging Jesus again. They're begging Jesus to heal this deaf man with a speech impediment. They are welcoming Jesus. Why now? Well, very well be because Jesus turned the demoniac into an evangelist. In chapter 5, verse 19, Jesus told him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." It's one of the few times, if not the only time, that Jesus tells somebody to go and tell people, all right? Keep that in your mind as we move through our passage. And then Mark 5:20 says that he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Well, let's look at verses 33 to 37. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, the deaf man, he put his fingers into his ears and after spitting, touched his tongue. I just kind of want to say, ooh, at that. You know, it's like, ugh. You know, it just doesn't, just sounds funny, doesn't it? And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephatha," that is, "be opened." And his ears were opened. His tongue was released and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He makes even the deaf hear and the mute speak. So the way Jesus heals the man has a personal touch, doesn't it? What does he do? He takes him away from the crowd. Jesus cares about this man, and the presence of the crowd isn't important, perhaps even detrimental. The crowd is usually seen as negative in Mark. The man can't hear, so Jesus uses touching and motions that would help communicate what Jesus was going to do to this guy. Jesus looks up to heaven, perhaps signaling that Jesus is from heaven and that God is the source of this healing. Jesus heals the man and then tells them to tell no one. Jesus has been doing that a lot, hasn't he? He's been shutting up people. He's telling the demons not to say anything. He told the leper. But no surprise that the crowd is astonished beyond measure and says that he has done all things well. But before we move on, let's circle back to Jesus sighing. Now, did you mentally sigh as I read that verse? Verse 36. So I'm going to read that again, and then this is our chance to verbally sigh together. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. All right, sigh. Ugh. It's like nodding. You know, some have said, you know, maybe Jesus looked up to heaven and he sighed because it's like, not again, Lord. Well, I think that's a reasonable response of Jesus. So here's the first group of people that must move us with compassion. The disobedient. The crowd, which apparently now includes the deaf man. Notice what Mark says. He says, he charged them to tell no one, which would include the deaf man. But they do. They tell people. They're disobedient. And we've seen this kind of disobedience before, haven't we? Way back in the beginning of the Gospel of Mark in chapter 1, when Jesus healed a leper. And in chapter 1, verse 43, Jesus sternly warned the leper to say nothing to anyone. That sternly warned. And if you were here then, you may remember that the word for sternly charged, or it could mean sternly charged, has its roots in what? You remember? Michaela, do you remember, you know, the horse people? It has its roots in the snorting of a horse. Jesus seemed to be aware that the leper wasn't going to obey him, and he was expressing his displeasure ahead of time. And he had this whatever that snorting, that word, you know, it was, Jesus wasn't pleased. He knew what the leper was going to do. So what was the result of the leper's disobedience? Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in desolate places. Now, could it be a coincidence that in the next scene in this passage, where do we find Jesus? He's in a desolate place. Maybe another example of Markan irony. So again, we see Jesus reacting ahead of time. He didn't sternly charge them with the hint of a snorting horse this time. But what did he do? He sighed. Jesus had compassion on the deaf man, even though he knew that the deaf man and the crowd were going to disobey him, just like the leper. All right, everyone sigh. Oh, you know, it's just... Mark, I think Mark is hilarious because, remember, he doesn't do as much teaching as he does just kind of telling about Jesus' life. And it's like, all right, I'm putting it out there for you guys to notice, for the Holy Spirit perhaps to speak through a preacher, to do a work in our hearts. But it's there. We should sigh when that happens. It's like, not again. There's an allusion in this passage to Isaiah 35 that Kevin read earlier, verses 5 to 6. It says, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame man shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. Jesus is fulfilling messianic prophecy. Why might Jesus be disappointed? Why might he sigh? What might be another reason? Because they don't completely understand who Jesus is. Jesus is Lord and one to be obeyed. He's more than a miracle worker. He's more than a Jesus, a Santa Jesus, more than a healer. He's his healing of this deaf man. I'm going to do that again. Deaf man points to him as Savior and Lord. People in authority are often misunderstood, aren't they? Have you ever been in a position of authority and been misunderstood? Yeah, it's not hard. Well, like the police, for instance. The police are there to protect and serve. In fact, if you saw, we saw it on Saturday, at Wheaton, they park a squad car near where we walk. I think it's just to try to, they do this around Wheaton. I don't know if they do this in Aurora or not, but there's nobody sitting in it. It's there to show that, hey, we're here. You know, there might be somebody here, so don't do anything stupid. And what's on it? To protect and serve. The police have authority. They have guns. They aren't perfect people. And that's why you don't want to do anything stupid when you have an encounter with them. Do an analysis of the high-profile deaths involving police just in the last year. Note how many were killed because they weren't acting wisely. How many of them? They were acting unwisely before imperfect people who are fearing for their own lives. Now, they're fearing for their own lives sometimes on a daily basis. How would you like to be a policeman in today's day and age? Constantly having to put up with people who are just being jerks, you know, calling you names, throwing stuff at you. It's just, I don't know why anybody would want to be a police officer. Now, I grew up in the time, I don't know if this is just the age that I grew up in, but I grew up fearing the police. I grew up with a sense that I knew they were imperfect. You know, they did stupid stuff to people. And so I knew that, all right, I am not going to do anything to antagonize a police officer because he can do something bad to me, right? You know, I don't. That's the way I grew up. I think actually police have gotten better over the years. You know, you hear stories about, you know, I had friends, you know, police would pull them over, they'd open up their trunk and they'd see a basketball and the police saw a nice basketball and they'd take the basketball, you know? So, you know, you just wanted to avoid an encounter with the police. Now, maybe the police were trying to teach that person, you know, maybe they didn't want the basketball as much as they were trying to teach respect. I don't know. But I just grew up with that kind of sense. There are bad cops out there, but the vast majority of them are good. So Michaela and Nathan, you know, you should see the police, you know, as good. And listen to them and don't do something stupid when you get pulled over someday, okay? I think it's just gonna happen, all right? So Nathan, you know. You know, I don't know the example of your father, how if he has a lead foot or not, if he's been fat, you know. But so Larry's shaking his head, okay, so this isn't confession time. So anyways, you know, it's likely you're going to have an encounter with a police sometime. Respect them. Don't do anything stupid. Now, most people recognize that the vast majority of police are not bad. And they recognize this, and they support defunding of the police. Even in the areas where some of this bad stuff has happened, they don't support the defunding and reducing the police force. And you probably read, you know, maybe the news reports or even seen on TV. In the areas where they have reduced the police force, what has crime done? Well, it's gone up. Well, duh, right? What do you expect? So we sigh when the role of the police isn't understood and isn't valued and isn't respected. So we can understand Jesus sighing when the leper and the crowd don't understand who Jesus really is. But thankfully, Jesus came to have compassion on us, the disobedient. We should always see ourselves in these passages because we know our own sin. So we've first been challenged that we must be moved with compassion for the disobedient. We will now be challenged to be moved by compassion for the deficient. We must be moved by compassion for the deficient. In those days when again, I love that word, again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from far away. In those days. Well, in what days? In the days when Jesus was in the region of the Decapolis. No surprise that a great crowd has gathered. Why? Because in 736, it says that the group witnessing the healing of the deaf man zealously proclaimed his healing. Voila! He's got a great crowd once again. And apparently a very great and now hungry crowd. They've been with Jesus for 3 days and they've run out of their store of food. Jesus feels compassion for this crowd who is deficient of food. Now, all right, so I was going to stick in another point there, but I'm not. Now, not only are they deficient of food, they're deficient from obtaining it by the time they arrive home. Jesus said they're going to faint on the way. So let's see how the disciples respond. They've already witnessed Jesus providing for 5,000 men, not including women and children. What would you expect them to say? Something like maybe, oh yeah, Jesus, yeah, we get this. You're asking us to follow your example and provide bread for the crowd, just like you did for the 5,000. or maybe we shouldn't expect that much spirituality from them. How about maybe this response would have been legitimate, right? How about, you did such a nice job providing for the 5,000. How about doing that miracle again? The disciples respond in verse 4. And his disciples answered him. You just got to laugh. How can one feed these people with bread here in this, what, desolate place? You know, it's like here they are again in a desolate place. So what is our response? Sigh, all right, sigh, everybody. Oh. You know, not a, geez, what? These disciples over and over, they're, you know, Jesus' disciples of all people. It's a real groaner, isn't it? Just want to groan. The crowd is deficient of bread and the disciples are deficient in the head. Sorry, couldn't resist that little rhyme there. Now, the Greek word for bread is literally loaves. We mentioned that in the last incident. And those of you who were here for the incident of the 5,000 may remember the significance of the loaves. Think about that. I'll get to that in a moment. But first, let's read the rest of our passage this morning, 5 to 10. And he asked them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. So the question in verse 5 is the same question that Jesus asked them back in the incident of the 5,000. In 6:38, he said, how many loaves do you have? You know, it's like, there's just, Mark is just signaling all these things, you know. And that passage included one of the most interesting statements. And I don't have time to go into all of it, but you can listen to the sermon online and include chapter 6, verse 38. But Mark includes the incident of the disciples being terrified by Jesus walking on the water. So Jesus does this miracle, provides the miracle of the bread. Then they get into a boat, and Jesus walks on the water, scares the bejeebies out of them, gets back in the boat, and then Mark gives us this statement. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves. After, you know, it's like, wait, that loaves thing happened back after, you know, the wind. But anyways, but their hearts were hardened. Well, they still don't understand about the loaves. Why? Because their hearts are hardened. Nothing's changed. The disciples' hearts are hardened. This incident ends the same way as the 5,000, leftover food and leftover baskets. Now, I'm not going to get creative and try to speculate. You know, we had 12 baskets then. We have 7 baskets now. You know, there's just no reason to do all that. There's no reason to speculate on that. Mark doesn't. So why would we? Also, just like the 5,000, the point is, I think, that there was leftovers again. You know, you wonder what the disciples did with those 12 baskets. You know, perhaps then, you know, the number was exactly matching. 12 baskets, 12 disciples, you know. It's like, okay, keep this in mind, guys. But anyways, but just like the 5,000, what did Jesus and his disciples do? Well, they get into a boat when the people are fed. So the incident is over. But think about this. This passage is full of deficient people. First, we have a man deficient in hearing and speech. Then we have a great crowd from the region of the Decapolis. They're deficient of food. And the disciples are still deficient of their understanding of who Jesus is. All of them are deficient in some way or another and need the compassion of Jesus. The challenge for us is what moves Jesus must move us. We must be moved by compassion for the disobedient and the deficient. Why must we be moved? Because we understand our own disobedience and our own deficiency. We are only Christians because Jesus had compassion on us when we were disobedient and deficient. And we are still disobedient and deficient, aren't we? Should cause us to have mercy on others and compassion because we can relate to them. So let's get back to our modern day example of disobedience and deficiency. To Dante Wright. It's too late to have compassion on him. But we can learn from his situation. I don't know if you've read reports or whatever, but something his father was reported to have said. He gave an interview apparently to the Washington Post, and Bradford Betts reported this from Dante Wright's father, Aubrey. He said, "I know my son. He was scared. He still had the mind of a 17-year-old because we babied him. He was a great kid. He was a normal kid. He was never in serious trouble." Well, court records tell a different story about how great and how normal of a kid he was. A story about never being in serious trouble. Is it normal for a good kid to allegedly and be identified in a lineup for robbing a woman at gunpoint? Does a normal kid do that? Is it normal for a good kid to have a warrant out for his arrest for violating parole? Well, no. And there's more to his record than that. So think about this. We've really got to think about this. Was his mother and father partly to blame for his death? Parents, that's why it's so crucial. We have to train our kids to respect authority. How could they have not known that there was a warrant out for their son's arrest? Right? You know, like the police are going to show up at home. You know, we've got to, you know, it's like, come on. You know, I just don't get this situation and all the rhetoric that's going around. It just doesn't make sense. If this were my son, I would have had compassion on him by turning him over to the police. Why? Because he is safer under authority rather than out from under it. All right? So Nathan, Michaela, I don't know that you're going to, you know, the females, you know, they're usually pretty good. Nathan, you know, it's you that we usually have to worry about, right? It's the guy, okay? So just, you know, you're safer under authority. They're there to protect you. The police are there to protect and to serve the community from the Dante Wrights of the world, people that are going to hold you up with a gun. And in reality, the police are there to protect Dante from himself. If a suspect is evading the law and is known to have a gun, because of an incident with a gun, and that person has an altercation with the police, do you think the police are going to be a little bit more on edge? Have anybody seen the video of Dante Wright's arrest? He tried to escape the police, right? So you have this police officer. Did you see him trying to handcuff Dante? It's like he's fumbling around. You know, in the movies, man, I don't know if they practice or whatever, but you know, the police officer was not putting the handcuffs on very fast. You think, man, if he would have just put that cuff on any sooner, would his life have been, you know, it's just, you just look at how all this situation just goes bad at that, but every turn. But perhaps the father hit the nail on the head when he said, "We babied him." That's so sad. How do people usually grow up who have been babied? They turn into dysfunctional adults. That's what happens. Is babying having compassion? Nathan, if your parents babied you, would you think that's having compassion? Well, maybe as a 12, you're 12. How old are you? Yeah, you're 12. As a 12-year-old, maybe you think that's having compassion, but it's not having compassion. All right, good. Shake and say, good man. Yeah, all right. Way to go. You know, that's not having compassion. Some parents think so. And if you baby your child, you're just setting them up for this kind of scenario. We've got to speak the truth. A disrespect for the authority and the idea that you can get away with stuff. His father said that he had gone to his mother and asked for $50 to go for a car wash. I don't know, maybe car washes in Minneapolis are $50, but $50, you know, why would you even say that to the police, you know, to the news? Yeah, it's for $50. Well, you know, normal people reading that is like, would just go, huh? I've never paid $50 for a car wash. You know, maybe he's going to get it detailed. There's just so much with the scenario that's just wrong and sad. I grieve for his family. I really do. Because I try to put myself in their position, but they have to take some responsibility for his death. So, how does this situation with Dante relate to the gospel? The gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, what's weird about this passage is that we can't take direct application, right? Let me know if you can perform miracles of healing and do multiplying of bread. You know, we'll put you in charge of the next, you know, breakfast, and we'll just hand you a loaf of bread. It's all right, man. Here we go. Sure, you know, just multiply some loaves for us, and maybe bring a casserole. You know, we don't have to worry about that. We don't perform miracles of healing and multiplying fresh and fish and bread, and it's like the crowd wasn't poor. So it's not like, okay, yeah, you know, Jesus is having compassion on the poor, so we need to provide for the poor. Well, that would be kind of like doing an application that kind of like does an end around run. So I just don't want to go there. But how do we come up with an application for this passage? So here's how I'm going to apply it from a gospel perspective. All right. Now again, if you have questions and you think I've blown this thing, ask me, talk to me. If you don't talk to me, I don't know how some of the things that I come across. I must be very clear because nobody hardly ever has any questions. So I can't believe that that's true, all right? So please come and see me if you got questions. But I want to bring a Christian biblical worldview to our events. First of all, we're all guilty. We're all guilty before God. And what is our natural reaction? What is our natural reaction when we're guilty? Well, we want to flee. We want to get away from judgment and justice. And, you know, we like our guiltiness. And isn't this what essentially Adam and Eve did in the garden? The very first fleeing from guilt and from sin. And what did they do after they had sinned? They hid from God. God calls out to them and says, "Where are you?" Genesis 3:10 records Adam's response, and he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, And I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. What caused Adam's fear? Guilt. Maybe Dante's father should realize that it's you know, we flee when we're guilty. So it isn't surprising that Dante feared the police. I've run from police before. I won't talk about, you know, that. But he was guilty, and he knew they were looking for them. So even in the presence of three police officers, he made the unwise decision to flee. You know, that's not going to turn out well. This is a picture of one way our world views God. He is someone to flee from, someone who makes them afraid. He is a holy, righteous, and just God, a just God who will one day judge the guilty. But we have that, but that's not today. He offers us mercy and compassion. We think that by fleeing God, we can escape our guilt. But we can't. We can't escape God's judgment. So how does God fix this problem for us? Our problem of disobedience and being deficient of our ability to save ourselves. Our deficiency in goodness. God fixes our problem by providing somebody who is good. Someone who is good for us. God provided his sinless son to die for our guilt. Why? Because he has compassion on us. And even though we are disobedient, he has compassion on us now. He knows that we are deficient to save ourselves, so he has compassion on us. Just like that's a direct parallel, you know? It's like he let 3 days go by in this crowd so that there is no way they could provide for themselves. And what does he do? He steps in and provides for them. That's what Jesus has done for us. We can't provide salvation on our own, and he steps in and provides it for us through his death. This broken world should make us long for a perfect authority. It will never be the government. It will never be the police. It will only be God. And when Jesus comes back, that is the time we will see the perfect authority. Our broken world should make us realize that we need a perfect authority. What moves Jesus must move us, and what moves Jesus is compassion for the disobedient and the deficient. Perhaps this is the ultimate compassion that we can show to a broken world, to the Dante writes, to his parents, to our politicians, to declare to a guilty world. We can't take away the guilt like some pastors try to do. No, we preach a little fuzzy Jesus. You know, the world is guilty. We need to be confronted with our guilt because we need compassion. We need a compassionate God who is willing to forgive us for our sin. A compassionate God who sent his son to die for our sins and to suffer the suffering that we should do. A loving God worth running to, rather than running from. If we are moved with compassion for a guilty world, we will call them to humbly admit their guilt, to confess Jesus as Lord, obey him, and follow him. Let's pray.